It's Song Talk Radio with Michael, Neil, Phil, and the gang.
Hey there out there in podcast land, guess what? It's Song Talk Radio, and we are here to trade tips and tricks with each other so that hopefully by the end of this here episode, we all learn at least three new things on how to write better songs. And to take part in all of this tip trading is the usual cast of the Song Talk Radio team. Mr. Neil Modi, how you doing, Neil?
I'm doing very good. Ready for some trading?
Okay. And of course, on my left, Mr. Michael Proudfoot. How you doing, Michael?
I'm doing quite well. Looking forward to a few tips and a better technique.
That's true. But you know, we really want to hear from you, the podcast listener or online listener. So whatever your thoughts, why don't you send us an email to feedback@songtalk.ca. What you like about the show, what you like to change, or perhaps your favorite cocktail recipe, even that. Michael gave a great one, the paper plane, I think you were calling it, Mike.
Yeah.
What was that again?
That recipe is equal parts bourbon, Aperol, Averna, and lemon juice.
It is very good. I can attest to that. And out there in podcast land, you can also send us a tweet to at Song Talk Radio, and that would just be awesome. And speaking of awesome, our guest tonight is a longtime guest here at Song Talk Radio. Not only is he an amazing person, but he also has a scary big music brain, and he often comes on to talk in depth on all things songwritery and compositionally. Hey. It is songwriter and film composer Jeff Greenway. Jeff, thanks for coming on.
Hello, Jeff.
Thank you for having me. It's great
to be back. Welcome back, Jeff.
See you guys again.
Yeah, you too.
So, Jeff, you've been, you made the switch from songwriter to film composer, and just wondering, how's that journey been going?
It's been really interesting and really refreshing for me. I'd been doing the singer-songwriter thing for many, many years, and although I still love playing songs, writing songs, performing, all that kind of stuff, I needed a change. I needed to get out of that and to try something different. So I've actually wanted to be a composer ever since I was like about six. You know, first time I saw Star Wars, first time I saw E.T., you know, all that stuff. It just really inspired me to want to do film music, but I never thought I could do it. I had a jazz education and a pop education, and you know, most of the film composers, they come from, you know, long storied classical backgrounds and many, many years of study and that sort of thing. But I decided I was going to dive in, and it's been a real learning experience. And I think it probably will be till the day I die. I mean, you can learn so much about film music. It's really a little bit of everything. It's classical, it's jazz, it's pop, it's rock. Like you really have to know a little bit of almost every style of music to be a good film composer.
In the past, you never dabbled in like orchestral arrangements and things like that, just as an aside?
I kind of started by doing string arrangements. So I studied that a little bit when I went to Humber College, when I did the jazz program. So we did some big band arranging, we did some strings arranging. And when I did some of my recordings, actually on my a couple of my singles that I released, I did string arrangements for those. Mm-hmm. And I did some for some other artists as well. So I kind of started with that. And I always love strings. Like one of my favorite film composers is Ennio Morricone, who sadly passed away a couple months ago. He did some beautiful, lush string arrangements. And that's something that I've always sort of gravitated towards. And so I kind of started with that, and I played around with that a bit. And I actually got some, you know, some string players to come in and perform them, which is a real eye-opening experience. I realized that I'd written half the charts wrong. so you learn as you go along. Yeah. So it kind of started with that. And I did do a little bit of electronic stuff. You know, I dabbled in different things. I did some jazz, instrumental jazz stuff when I was at Humber. But yeah, it wasn't really until I kind of finally made the decision. It's like, okay, I'm going to do this for real. And then I just, I just made the switch 100% basically.
And you actually, you took a university course a couple of years ago, didn't you, on film music?
Not university. Basically, what I did is I took a combination of courses from different places. So I did Berklee Online, which has a wonderful film scoring program. And they actually have a whole degree you can take. What I did is I just took some of the specific film and TV writing courses. And then I also studied orchestration with the Canadian Film Center. They had a program there with John Herberman, which was fantastic. So I kind of filled in bits and pieces that I went. I also took some other online courses with different things like mixing and mastering and other orchestration stuff. There's a lot of free videos and tutorials out there too. There's a lot of things you can actually learn about it without even having to go to school.
One thing I wanted to ask you, Jeff, is, you know, most of our DAWs come with, you know, some string instruments, virtual instruments, but the ones I know that the, you know, film composers use mm-hmm. are crazy expensive, like $20,000 type thing. Can you explain the difference between those two things?
Yeah, sure. So they've come down quite a bit. So they're not as expensive as they used to be. That's actually one of the reasons why I got into this when I did. It was really, really expensive a few years back to get those samples. So what they are is they're plugins basically for your DAW, and they will work with pretty much any DAW out there. But they're made by different manufacturers, and these manufacturers basically sample orchestras, and they sample real instruments, and they give them to you in a very powerful package. One of the first ones to do this was East West and Quantum Leap. They're primarily known as East West now. And they actually started with a monthly subscription. Before, their packages cost like, I don't know, upwards of $20,000, $30,000 for like a good package of orchestral instruments. And now basically you can get it for about $30 a month. And you have access to all their libraries. So that was a big sort of game changer. And I don't like to promote, you know, one company over another, but that was the reason for me getting in, because I couldn't afford to, you know, spend tens of thousands of dollars on samples. Generally, they're a lot cheaper now. Like, you can get a really good sort of orchestral package for generally around, you know, $400 to $600. They're kind of around that range now. There are some really expensive ones still out there, but they're not necessarily better just because they're more expensive. And you kind of have to get a little bit of everything, right? You find when you start doing it, you start with like a basic orchestral package. So you got the strings and the brass and the, you know, the big drums and all that sort of thing. And then somebody asks you, like in this case, this film that I just finished now, they want you to do 1940s jazz. And I'm looking through all my samples, like, I don't have anything for 1940s jazz. So, you know, you got to do some research, and then sometimes you got to go out and actually buy some samples or try to find something that you can work with. And as a film composer, you get all sorts of weird requests. You know, somebody wants kazoo, you know, or they want, you know, 1930s banjo or something like that. And unless you actually have a player who can do that, you have to actually go out and get a sample library for that.
How important do you feel, Jeff, it is for you to understand? I mean, I realize you don't necessarily play violin, viola, cello, banjo, all these brass instruments, woodwind instruments, unless maybe you do, but I'm assuming that most composers don't. Like, how important is it for you to understand, and how much do you need to understand about how those instruments operate and how they actually, you know, work and all the articulations that are possible and all that sort of stuff?
It's important. I would say it's more important if you're actually working with real musicians. So if I was to go, for instance, and do a score, you know, on an LA soundstage or something like that, and I had like a real orchestra and I had to write out parts for them, it's super important, right? And often a lot of composers will bring in orchestrators to double check things or to help them with that, because there can be so many things that can go wrong, you know, especially when you're writing 50 parts for a piece of music. So for that, for sure, it's really, really important. When you're working with samples, it's not as important, although if you really want it to sound real, if you want it to sound like a real orchestra, you want it to sound like like real musicians are playing this, you do have to have sort of a basic understanding of how all those instruments work so that you don't accidentally put the clarinet up too high and, you know, have the strings playing lower than they can actually go, that kind of thing, right? So you do have to kind of, that's where orchestration comes in. So when you study orchestration, you learn the range of each instrument, you learn about different techniques that they can use and that sort of thing. So you can do it without that. And there's actually a lot of great examples. One of the soundtracks that I listened to recently that I really love was the music from Watchmen, which was Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. And they don't have any orchestra, as far as I know, they don't have any orchestral background whatsoever. And it was a very synth heavy score, but it was wonderful. So it depends what you're doing. I think if you're doing traditional orchestral, you know, John Williams type music, then yeah, you should definitely, you know, try to take like an orchestration course, even if it's like an introduction to orchestration, so that you can learn how all those instruments work. So you can put it together realistically, even if you're doing it in your DAW.
Hmm. Very cool. Could you tell us like what the difference between those expensive instrument packages versus what comes with our DAW?
Realism, really. That's what it comes down to. Like, for instance, I have Logic, and Logic has a wonderful collection of instruments, and some of them are pretty decent. I actually use, you know, some of the synths, some of the percussion and that kind of thing, even in film score writing. But, you know, things like strings, things like woodwind instruments, brass, really don't sound real in those packages, because they don't have as much information, I would say, in the sampling. So when you get these specialty packages, they've really sort of sampled everything, and they've put a lot of expression into the performance of each of those instruments, and really tried to model it more realistically, so that you have it's almost like I would compare it to, you know, like a small JPEG versus like a huge, you know, TIFF file or something like that for those people who are into graphics, right? It's just a lot more information in the professional samples. And it will, you still have, there's quite a learning curve in terms of how to make it sound real still. Like, you have to use expression and you have to use modulation. And there's all these things that you kind of have to figure out how to use. It's almost like learning how to play an instrument without actually playing an instrument. So there's a lot of work in trying to make it real, but it does sound much more realistic than generally what you get from the factory.
So Jeff, I was wondering, now that you're doing composing, what was the big difference between that and being a songwriter? How does the process work for you now? Because you're not initiating the creative spark, but you still obviously have to bring a lot of creativity to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's there's so many differences. It's both sides are wonderful. I still, like I said, I really enjoy songwriting. And the nice thing with songwriting is you are your own creator. What you make, what you write, what you play is completely up to you, and you can be inspired by something, or you can just create something on the spot. When you do work with film, I would say that's the biggest difference. When you go into it, you realize, okay, this isn't about me anymore. This is about the film, and everybody who's working on the film, from the director on down, has to, you know, their vision has to serve the film's vision. So I'm enhancing the picture, and the composer is enhancing the picture rather than bringing in something of their own 100%. So I can still bring in some of my own creativity, of course, and I can, you know, think of original things to bring in. But the director always has the final say. That's something that can be a bit jarring sometimes, you know, when you have a certain vision and the director has a different vision. And I've had, you know, a few clashes in the past where they see things one way and I see things another way. And so sometimes you butt heads a little bit. But one thing I find fascinating is that if I watch a really moving scene, something that's really stirring to me emotionally, you know, it could be like a love scene, an action scene, whatever it is, that really inspires me as a composer. I get ideas that I wouldn't necessarily have had on my own. So, you know, I start thinking, oh, you know, this would sound really good with, you know, some fast, you know, timpani drums or something like that. And you start really thinking, in my case, thinking almost more creatively because you have this outside inspiration. The process is very different. You know, when I used to write songs, I would usually come up with a chord progression and then a melody and then lyrics usually last. I know some people work the other way around. With film composition, it can start anywhere. You know, it can start with a drum beat. It can start with a flute melody. It could start with, you know, a violin part. And then you kind of build things around that. I personally sketch things out on piano because I'm a pianist. So when I'm watching a film for the first time and I have to figure out how to do the music, I'll actually just kind of start noodling away on the piano and start thinking about things that kind of fit with what's happening on the screen.
I imagine one of the differences would be the fact that, you know, when you're writing a song, it comes from an inspiration. You're playing around with your instrument and you think, oh, that's kind of cool, and you build on that. But as a film composer, you get the job in, and I'm not sure what the turnaround time is on those, but suddenly you've got to sort of create, and you might not have an idea in your head, but you still have to make something, you know? Must be an interesting experience.
Yeah, I've heard some horror stories about that. I luckily haven't run into any yet, but I've heard some people have had to come up, you know, with a score for like a whole TV episode or for a short film in like 2 days or 24 hours. I haven't had to do that luckily yet, although I did do a quarantine film. So it was like a short film that was done in quarantine. And I had 48 hours to do the soundtrack for that. So that was a tight one. It was a good challenge, though. It was actually a really good challenge. It kind of forced me to do stuff. I'm the kind of person who needs a deadline. Otherwise, I just keep noodling forever. So it's good for me to have a deadline. I don't necessarily like a 48-hour one, but they often don't leave enough time for music. It's a sad fact of the industry. If you're lucky, you get a couple of weeks. But often it's like a week or, you know, and on a large film, you know, I haven't done like a full length feature, but you usually get about, you know, 3 weeks to a month to work on that. But that's ideally. And sometimes there's so much music in those, they have to bring in outside composers to help. So they'll have like a team. Hans Zimmer famously has, you know, a team of like, I don't know, 500 people or 1,000 people working under him, you know, that, you know, just jump in, you know, to help out.
In terms of what the director or the filmmaker gives you, it, like, the, for instance, is when you're sharing tonight, you said they wanted 1940s jazz. Like, does it sort of run the gamut between the directors just like do whatever you feel like, or they have very, very specific requirements and even like reference music that they want you to sort of, you know, be inspired by or whatever?
Yeah, it depends on the director and the producer. Often the producer will get involved as well. Hopefully it's just the director. Otherwise you can get like this crazy sort of three-way tag team match.
Too much cooks in the kitchen. Eh?
Yeah. But it depends on the director. I've worked with some directors where they just said, oh, you know, just do whatever you want. And then other ones, and this is more common, they'll put in what they call temp tracks. Yes. So they'll actually have some music that they've found themselves that they think sort of suits the scene. And they'll put that in as sort of a placeholder to give you an idea of what they're looking for. And some of them, if they're musicians themselves or if they have some music background, they'll be very, very specific in what they want. In this particular film that I guess we'll be listening to a little bit later on, called The Window Seat. This is where they wanted the 1940s jazz music. And that was very, very specific. So they actually gave me a temp track for, it was actually a Japanese 1940s boogie woogie piece that was playing on a record player in the scene of this, in this particular scene. And I was listening to it thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do? How can I do this? They had a singer too. And it, of course, it all sounded old, you know, it was on a scratch. It was old scratchy recording. So that was a real eye-opener for me. I had to really, really think about that to come up with some ideas. But yeah, they can sometimes be very specific about what they want, and sometimes they just say, go for it. And I'm actually, to be honest, I'm a lot more scared of the ones that say just try anything, because often you do that and then they don't like it.
Yeah, that was my next question, is that the more specific they are, the more focused you can be, and the chances of them liking what you do is probably higher.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, sometimes too much freedom is a bad thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Jeff, do you always start with a picture, or do sometimes you have to start without anything other than maybe a script or some suggestions? Or do you always have some picture lock, or at least a rough cut to go by?
Yeah, it depends when you come in the process. I've come into some films where they haven't finished the shooting yet, and they barely even have a rough cut. Mm-hmm. And in that case, they'll send a copy of the script, and they'll tell you all about the story and that sort of thing. And then you can start thinking of ideas at that point. But I find it really hard without at least having a rough cut to kind of get an idea of the right tone, you know, the right, even the right genre of music, you know, what's going to fit with this. But you usually start, like, you really start getting into the nitty gritty of writing the music when you get either a rough cut or a final cut. It really should be the locked final cut. But as they say these days in film, there is no such thing as a locked final cut anymore. So you're lucky if you get one, but often it just keeps changing.
And is it the sort of thing where they'll, you know, if there isn't a locked cut, then they take your music, they then re-edit, then they have to, do you then have to sometimes rewrite things, or because they make cuts in weird places and the music doesn't quite fit anymore or something like that happens?
Yeah, you really want to try not to have them do the editing, because sometimes, depending on who the editor is, if they're not a musician, they can do the weirdest cuts in, like, bizarre places, and then you're listening to it. It's a Frankenstein cue or something. So, yeah, usually they will ask you to do it. And it's time-consuming, but, you know, ultimately, you're the person who has the credit as the composer in the end. So you want to make sure that it's representing your music the way you want it to in the film. So if you leave it up to somebody else to move it around and to edit it, and then you really don't know what you're going to end up with. So I prefer to do it myself, but yeah, it is very time consuming. And sometimes you're doing it 5, 6, 7, 8 times.
No, but I mean, like, just say you're in the midst of composing the music and you've sent some tracks over, mm-hmm. and even in your mind, they're finalized, but then they decide from a dramatic yeah. point of view, or from a scene point of view, oh, they need to cut, you know, this minute out of it, or, you know, that shot mm-hmm. wasn't quite right, or something like that. Does that then have implications back on you to have to rewrite something or to change something in your score?
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of things that can happen. Sometimes they'll just take out a cue, right? Or they'll cut it, right? Then maybe they'll do an early fade out or something like that. That's one possibility on their end. Sometimes they'll, you know, edit it and stitch it together the way that they want. But yeah, like, ultimately, it's on the composer usually, right, to have to rewrite that or shorten it or lengthen it or whatever it is that has to be done to conform to what it is that they changed.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Maybe this is a bit of an odd question, but like we as film watchers, and we watch content all the time, streaming and all that sort of stuff, right? We're always hearing stuff with the final score. When you're looking at a picture that you're scoring, there ain't no music.
Yep.
Right. And we're always tying, I mean, hopefully not so it's like, you know, really forced, but sometimes we're tying the emotion of the scene in with the help of that music. The music supports the emotion of that scene. So like, where's the connection for you? Like, you're like, I feel like if I was to watch a scene without any music in it, like it's such a strange foreign place to start. Like, how do you actually start there and actually conceive of something?
Yeah, it's a bit weird seeing films without music. It's really kind of bizarre. And at, you know, when you first start doing it, it's like, what do I do? Right. The nice thing is when the course that I took at Berkeley, was really good about that. They were, the whole first part of the course was analysis of the scene, you know, okay, so where should the music start in the scene? Where should it change? Where should the tempo be? All that kind of thing. One of the hardest things is to get the right tempo, right? Cause you have to figure out what's the beat of the scene. There is actually a beat in there.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of because of the editing that they do. And it can also be how fast the character's walking, you know, all those things you have to kind of take into account. And so you got to kind of think, okay, what's the beat of this? But even before that, you have to do what's called a spotting session, which is where you got to figure out where the music goes. Sometimes with short films, with independent films, which is mostly what I've been working on, they just leave it up to you. They say, okay, you know, you just put the music where you want. They might say, oh, well, I want music, you know, starting from, you know, when the car leaves the driveway or something like that. But they often can be very vague about it. In a big film, you actually sit down with the director and take notes, and it's like, okay, I want music in at, you know, 31.5 seconds or whatever to this point. And you have all these notes, right? So, you know, okay, this is where the music's going to start. This is where I'm out. And then you got to figure out, okay, how am I going to fit music in that part? And then if something changes in the scene, often there'll be like several moods. You know, it might start happy, and then there's a big revelation by one of the characters in the movie, and all of a sudden, oh, it's gone dark. So you have to think, okay, so what do I have to change? Where does it have to change? Right. So there's a whole flow there that you have to kind of look at. And you have to think about, you know, what's the character's motivation? What are they doing? What's the feeling in the scene? And also, where do you start and stop?
It's interesting because I always, you know, pay attention to film music. And it's, I think it's one of those art forms that the minute you notice it, that kind of means that it's not that good, because it should be basically just part of the movie, and it just, it brings you, you know, into the scene. Because I have noticed sometimes, I actually just saw a Canadian production on DVD. Heather and I were watching it the other day, and the music was just atrocious. it was just ham-handed and just the wrong thing. And I'm just going, God, let's get through. But what one thing I hate is when the music telegraphs the emotions.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not sure if they're doing that on purpose or if that's just sloppy or what is that?
Yeah, it can be a whole bunch of things. It could be that the, you know, the director's brother told them that's what they should do. Right. So you can't always blame it on the composer. Sometimes the composer wants something totally different and they're told, nope. I want this, you know, it has to be over the top. I want it over the top, right? I want it to telegraph this thing that's coming up. And yeah, so sometimes composers really cringe when that happens because they know they're going to be blamed in the end for how it turns out.
It's kind of like blaming actors for bad movies. It's like, it's not their fault. They're just doing a job. Yeah, it's like getting mad at the people who do the craft table, you know?
It's interesting, Jeff, what you say about finding the tempo of the scene, because like I'm working on a video project right now, but I'm doing the opposite thing. I'm trying to use found stock video footage to go along to some music. And of course the music has a tempo. That's a given, right? But how do you find the right video that's got that? It doesn't have to lock in precisely to the tempo, but some stuff, the action's just too fast for that, or it's just too slow, or you want to find that kind of balance, unless you're going for a high contrast, of course. Yeah. But you're right. There's a in any kind of art form that progresses over time, music, film, dance, all the rest of it, there's always some kind of a beat. And that doesn't mean that the person walking, you know, you're the beat of your drum is exactly in sync with the footsteps, but there's some kind of relationship there that just feels right or it doesn't feel right.
Yeah. And that's often why it's better to get a composer, right, rather than use stock tracks. And I've heard that quite a few times before where people will try to use stock tracks, but they, you know, it's not long enough. It's too short. It's too fast. It's too slow, right? You find something that suits the mood of what it is you want, but it doesn't quite fit. Mm-hmm. And that's where a composer can actually step in and write something that fits perfectly with that scene. Yeah.
Yeah. Michael, I wanted to ask you actually, because you're a film guy, a director of what has your experience been with film composers from the other side?
I've used both needle drop and stock footage, and it's also with composers. Needle drop is when you buy the rights to a song, you're just dropping the needle on it and it plays.
Right,
cool name.
Is, I guess, where that comes from. And my preference is to use a composer because it works out better, but often. Yeah, it's a bit more expensive. But what a composer can do is kind of to what you're saying, Phil, it can put the right tone in without you noticing it. And you can underline, like, say, the actor's being too subtle when he gets the information. You can just have a little, you know, beat or some kind of under, like a music moment there that you don't notice it being musical, but what you think you're seeing is you're seeing the actor's thought, but it's really done by the music. And so that kind of degree of subtlety, you can never get with stock music or needle drop. And then other times you kind of want to have something familiar. You want something musical, like, you know, a great example would be Scorsese. He uses a lot of needle drop and he uses it deliberately and really well. Like, you know, like it'll be sometimes to kick off a scene or, you know, just to underline an emotional moment. And part of that is, I think, going with the familiarity of the song in a different place. But I think it was the Godfather, I think it's Walter Murch, and I wonder how much the editor has to do with this, where there's no music during the scenes. The music tends to come after the emotional moment of the scene is over, and it's there to give you like a beat to absorb what just happened. It's like it sort of acts as a chapter heading almost. And so the way you use music in film, very much up to the director, and I guess it's also kind of part of the style, because the John Williams style where every emotional moment is underscored and underlined, I really hate that. I hate being led by the hand. Okay, now you're going to feel happy. Now you're going to feel sad. And I remember seeing Natural Born Killers, the Oliver Stone film. Yeah. And it's very overly scored. And, you know, very underlining the emotions. And I saw it in a cinema, and there were a couple of guys there, seats away from me, who I think had gotten a little high to watch this, and they were like really just into it. And they weren't the brightest guys, and they were missing the point. And it was hilarious because the film is so obvious. Okay, this is what's happening, and they're missing that. And then sometimes they're just laughing at the sound cues when there's like a sound. Like, oh, that's great. You know, so as much as you think you can, you know, think out everything and how the audience is going to feel, you don't. So, you know, those are kind of the bigger ones. But with short films, the ones I've worked on, I've been lucky enough to have composers, and it makes such a difference. It's like the picture gets clearer. It actually starts looking better when you've got a good score because you're being guided through it. And it's a real treat to have a film scored.
So Jeff, we're going to be playing one of your pieces. Can you talk about how you actually, how did this come together? Like, what was the process?
What's the project even? Like, how did this particular thing work from start to finish? Why did you get in touch with these people?
Well, as a composer, you're always kind of looking for what's out there. Often if you wait for somebody to say, hey, I need a composer, you're fighting with like about 500 other composers who also want the same work. So one of the things you try to do is you try to network, you try to look around and see if somebody's working on a film and they haven't maybe gotten to the point yet where they need a composer, and you approach them. So in this case, I noticed that there was this short film being done called The Window Seat. And it's by this director out of San Diego, California. And she had posted a whole bunch of pictures, basically, of the film in development, talked about the story. And it was a very interesting story. It was it's a film about Alzheimer's. It's a short film. And it's basically about Alzheimer's and the effect of it on the person and on the person's family, on their memories, all that kind of thing. And I found it really interesting myself, like that kind of drew me in because my grandparents suffered from dementia. And although it wasn't quite Alzheimer's, it was very similar. And so I approached her and I talked to her about it. We just got into a conversation and I said, hey, you know, if you're interested, you know, like to do the score for it. So we got into a conversation. She sent me the script. We talked about it some more, and then I did a draft for her, and she loved it. So we went from there. So it's the movie's called The Window Seat. It's directed by Chantal Ricks. Basically, it's about two characters, as a grandmother and a grandson. They live in the same house, and the grandmother has Alzheimer's. And so she's constantly sort of living out her memories. She's remembering her past. She's remembering her husband, who's passed away. The whole 1940s boogie woogie and all that kind of stuff comes from the fact that that's what she listens to. So in two of the scenes, she's listening to a record player, and the music, we call it source music when it's playing from a source in the film. So like a TV or a record player or something like that. So I wrote a couple of pieces that were sort of coming out of the record player on as if they're playing on vinyl as 1940s pieces. And then this particular cue that I think that you guys are going to play is not set in the past, right? So she's not imagining these memories from her past. What's happened is she's disappeared, and the grandson is trying to find her. And he's going through pictures. He starts by going through pictures and trying to look for clues as to where she might have gone. And then he realizes, she's said something to him before that makes him think that, okay, maybe she's gone to the train station and she's trying to go back to wherever she imagines her home is from her memories and that sort of thing. This particular music starts with the picture scene. It's kind of like a three-part cue. So basically it's going from this sort of sentimental scene where he's looking at all these pictures of his grandmother and her history. And then all of a sudden he realizes where she's gone. And then it's the trip to the train station, which is where she is. And so it's kind of like a travel cue almost, but it's also a very surreal scene. They've actually got pictures sort of floating through the air on this car trip. So I had to come up with something that sort of represented movement and travel, but also sort of this sort of fantastical kind of scene. Then he gets to the train station and he has to search for his grandmother. And then it's a bit more of a panicked kind of scene. So there's a bit more of an action sort of suspense type cue. In the end, he finds her, but she doesn't recognize him, which is kind of sad. So she thinks she's actually being attacked by a stranger. In the end, you know, everything's all good. They sort of make up again and they sort of find each other. It's actually a very nice ending to the movie, but that's sort of the scene that I wrote this music for. When you listen to it, you can kind of picture what's happening there. There's sort of like three distinct parts to it.
Does your cue end with the resolution or end with the, she thinks she's being attacked by somebody? Is that the end?
Ends sort of with the, where she thinks she's being attacked. So it's a bit more of a dramatic ending because there's a separate cue that comes after that.
Yeah. That's later on in the film. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what's the title of this one?
It's called Pictures.
Pictures. Okay. Let's take a listen. Thank you. Very nice.
Thank you. Big dramatic ending.
Yeah.
I have a question for you, Jeff. Just listening to it, it reminded me of something when I'm mostly going through stock music. You don't want too much melody in a track because it foregrounds it too much. Is that something that you have to play with when and where things are melodic or have a theme or, you know, the repetition? Is that something you have to be aware of?
Yeah, for sure. And if these were under dialogue, there would be a lot less melody. This particular cue is all silent, so there's no dialogue whatsoever. So I have a little bit more leeway with that. So that's why there's a little bit more melody in this. And I tried to have, there's certain themes that sort of recur through the movie. So that one little melody that you kind of hear on the violin, this kind of thing, kind of starts off in the picture section, and then it's sort of carried over into the violin in the car trip. And it also comes back again at the end of the movie. But I do try to keep it simple, and you don't want something that's sort of overblown, right? It has to fit the scene as well, right? So I'm trying to keep it as sort of, I guess as open as possible, right? That's why a lot of it actually doesn't have melody. It's more sort of chordal. It's more more harmony, with a little bit of melody here and there.
Mm-hmm. And that's certainly, is that something that they refer to as, what do they call it, underscoring, when it's underneath dialogue and stuff like
yes.
that? Is that what they call it?
Yeah.
And then, so if it's not underneath dialogue, what's it called? Scoring.
Score. Because it's not under anymore.
it's the over score. Do you find that that's a thing, like, as the years go on? Like, if you compare Hans Zimmer to John Williams, Hans Zimmer, younger, more modern composer, generally speaking, he's a lot less melodic than John Williams. John Williams was all about those catchy, poppy, in-your-face melodies. Hans Zimmer's about the boom and the bang and the chordal stuff more so. Do you find that's is that the way kind of things are moving these days?
Yeah, it's really changed quite a bit since, I would say, you know, from the 70s till now, 80s. You know, 80s was kind of like the pinnacle of film scores, I think, when John Williams was, you know, doing Star Wars and E.T. and all that stuff. And many of the other composers, you know, John Barry and a lot of the other ones did very similar things where there was a lot of melody, a lot of different themes and that sort of thing. And yeah, now there's a lot more, you know, long notes. There's a lot more, you know, pedal tones and drones and things like that. And there still is melody. And I think that it's sort of taken a bit of a back seat now. You know, you don't see as much melody, and a lot of the melodies are almost interchangeable. You know, you look at a lot of the superhero movies and that sort of thing. It's like you could almost slap one score on a different film, you know, which, you know, I don't like so much, but, you know, I'm sort of in between myself. Like, I love John Williams, but I would never write like John Williams. And, you know, I couldn't even if I tried, but, you know, like I couldn't put that much melody in. You know, it almost seems a little bit over the top now if you were to write a score like that, unless of course it's a throwback to that time. And I think there were some films that kind of did that. What was that film? Not The Flash. It was a superhero film where they did an almost John Williams type score. Shazam had an almost John Williams type score, and they wanted that specifically for that film to kind of make it a throwback to like those 80s movies.
Yeah. You really got to be a bit of a chameleon, don't you? Or like almost like a method actor in some senses. Like, if whatever they want, you got to deliver. And like, how much, like I know when I've, as a songwriter, if I've tried to write, you know, an opera piece or like a classical music or a hip hop song or something like that, it always kind of ends up sounding like me. Like, how much of you is in there, and how much are you able to divorce what you're composing from what you would naturally do, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, it's kind of tricky because as they say in the business, if you give one scene to 10 composers, you end up with 10 totally different cues, 10 totally different scores, because everybody's coming from a different place. You know, my music is going to sound quite different than another composer's, especially if they have more of a classical background than I do. I always have sort of a little bit of an element of pop and jazz in the music that I write. Even if I try to write it orchestrally, it doesn't come out sounding the same as somebody, you know, who's maybe studied classical for many, many years, right? It's quite different. But the interesting thing is it's every film I've done has been totally different. You know, I've done a horror film, I've done sort of nature documentary, I've done an action piece, and every single film I've learned something. So I've had to put myself in somebody else's shoes. In this case, I had to learn all about 1940s jazz. I had to do some research and listen to lots of music and figure out, okay, what kind of instruments are going to be in this, right? And then, you know, for instance, you got to look at the difference between 1940s jazz and 1960s jazz, or even 1920s jazz, because it's different instruments, it's different different groupings, they played things slightly differently.
Is it New Orleans, is it New York?
Harmony. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Lots of different things. So there's a lot of research actually involved in being a composer. When you get something thrown at you like that, you have to sort of immerse yourself in it. Like you say, like being a method actor, it's almost like being a method composer.
That's brilliant. So, Jeff, what's coming up for you these days?
Right now, I'm working on a theme for an independent... it's kind of like a horror slash grindhouse film, which is quite different from anything I've done. It's actually a song, a theme song, as opposed to a score. So that's something very different that I'm kind of working on right now. Other than that, I don't have anything else coming up at the present time. I'm always looking for stuff. And I'm always, you know, doing samples, you know, trying different styles and just writing stuff myself to just practice and to try different things.
That is so brilliant, because I think I hear the band. Uh-oh. And that means that's all the time we have tonight on Song Talk Radio. Special thanks to Jeff Greenway for stopping by with your big music brain.
Jeff,
thanks, Jeff.
Very informative.
Jeff, how do people get your get more of your stuff?
The website would be best. It's jeffallengreenway.com.
Fantastic.
How many L's in Allen?
A-L-A-N, only one.
Okay,
L.
Thank you.
All right. And don't forget, all you podcast listeners, we want to hear from you. So send us your comments on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at Song Talk Radio, or send us an email at feedback@songtalk.ca. Also, be sure to check out the YouTube channel for live performances, videos, and now actually full episodes just like this.
Pictures of us in boxes.
That's true. Now that we're all virtual-like. Subscribe today to the Song Talk Radio podcast on the favorite podcast provider. And don't forget to sign up for our free newsletter at the site songtalk.ca today. You can find links to all the products, books, and web services we mentioned here on Song Talk Radio on the resources page. And wherever you are in this world, why don't you stop by the next Song Talk meetup on Monday, August 24th from 7 to 10 p.m. on Zoom, Toronto time. It's free to join on meetup.com, free to attend the meetup. Stop by the site to find a link for that as well. Also, a big thank you to Vanessa Vreeland for all her help behind the scenes, and most of all, we'd like to thank you, the home listener. You can follow Neil at
neilmodi.com.
And how about Michael? How can people get in touch with you?
On Instagram, proudfoot420.
You can follow me at thephilemory on Twitter. And Jeff, do you have any other social media channels?
Yep, I'm on Facebook at Jeff Allen Greenway Music. As well as YouTube, again, Jeff Allen Greenway, and Instagram at Jeff Greenway.
Fantastic. And stop by the website at songtalk.ca to browse past shows and find out how you could be a guest just like Jeff. Stay safe, everyone, and keep on writing. Good night.
So long.
Peace. Bye.